Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Should we be drilling more for oil in this country? President Bush says it's the way to get ourselves out of a deepening energy hole, to which critics of the move warn we'll just be wasting time digging ourselves a deeper hole. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by BrandWeek, the news organization dedicated to the information needs of strategic-minded marketing executives with real-time coverage, now searchable at brandweek.com. And by gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad you're here on this Wednesday, the 18th of June, a day that began with President Bush suggesting anew that the country can drill its way toward lower oil prices. His response to the soaring cost of gasoline is opening America's coasts and Alaska's North Slope to oil prospecting. He's also pressing Congress to get rid of red tape that he claims has hindered the expansion of the nation's oil refining capacity. So, would more domestic drilling bring down pump prices? As Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, it depends on whom you ask.
President Bush says it'll be a while before the country can switch from oil to environmentally clean fuels.
And that means we need to increase supply, especially here at home.
The president said there are 18 billion barrels of oil within easy reach of the U.S. coastline. Rayola Duer at the American Petroleum Institute says those deposits could boost the nation's oil supply by 1 to 2 million barrels a day within 7 years.
The spare capacity in the world, the difference between supply and demand, is about 1.5 million barrels. And it's that thin line that's pushing the price up right now. We import 11 million barrels a day, so I look at that 1 to 2 as pretty significant to the United States and to the world.
The American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy figures the nation will save an equivalent amount, 2 million barrels a day, just from the latest increase in fuel efficiency requirements for cars, but not until 2025. And will the extra offshore oil be any cheaper? Joel Darmstadter at Resources for the Future, a Washington think tank, says that depends on the world market.
Why should a United States producer expect any less for the oil that he is producing than the oil that can be fetched on the world market? And that would mean that the payoff in terms of dollars and cents at the pump is likely to be much more in the cents area than in the dollar area.
That incremental consumer benefit, he says, has to be weighed against the social costs of potential ecological damage. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
How do you spell relief from sky-high fuel prices? For the aviation industry, it's R-H-E-N-I-U-M, rhenium. That's a rare silvery-white chemical element. It's one of several metals that can be used to make jet engines more fuel-efficient. As of this week, a pound of rhenium is worth more than $5,000. We're joined by Javier Blas. He reports on commodities for the Financial Times. Help us out, if you will, with why these metals are suddenly so hot.
Well, rhenium, cobalt, chromium, titanium are very extremely rare metals, are called the minor metals, and are very scarce, dispersed around the world, sometimes in Chile, in Kazakhstan, in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Why is it that these metals are in such demand for these aircraft engines?
These minor metals, such as rhenium, are in such a strong demand because when mixed with other metals, industrial metals like aluminium, we obtain a very strong and heat-resistant superalloys. Those new superalloys allows the engines to work at a higher temperature, and engineers have found that running the aircraft engines at a higher temperature allows to save jet fuel. So with oil prices near $140, that's a very interesting option for the airlines.
So are they worth their weight in gold yet, or are they just beginning to hit up?
Well, they are rising quite strongly. You look at the rhenium price in 2006, just 2 years ago, it was about $1,000 per kilogram. Today, it's trading nearly $12,000 per kilogram. That's about half of the cost of gold, so, and much more expensive than silver. So I was talking to a trader here in London, and he said, well, at current prices, it's going to be not so long that people is going to have rings and, you know, jewelry in rhenium rather than in silver.
You don't think much about rhenium, but it's a valuable commodity right now and is likely to become more valuable for the foreseeable future.
It is. Traders think that the price could continue to increase, but I don't think that the price is going to be a problem for the airlines because they are going to be more focused on the amount of crude oil they're going to save rather than the overall impact of rhenium on an airplane price. It's just a fraction of what a new Boeing or Airbus plane is going to cost. So airlines are going to continue to demand these new super alloys.
I'll wager it's still not as valuable as kryptonite, though. Javier Blas reports on commodities for the Financial Times. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
One thing that doesn't seem to be in short supply these days is entertainment. Now India, which has built its own movie industry with Bollywood, wants a piece of Hollywood. And today comes news it might get a big one. DreamWorks has been looking for a way out of its partnership with Viacom. And the studio is reported to be on the verge of a new deal with one of India's biggest companies. Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
When DreamWorks and Viacom's Paramount got together in 2006, it seemed like a match made in heaven. We are dream girls, boys, we'll make it happy. DreamWorks produced hits like Dreamgirls, Transformers, and Sweeney Todd, but claimed Paramount was taking all the credit. Then Viacom CEO said if Steven Spielberg left, it would be completely immaterial to the company's financial future. I will have vengeance. DreamWorks and Reliance could be a very strong match. The Indian conglomerate has agreed to sink $500 million into the Hollywood studio, and Reliance, already a telecom and financial services giant, wants to build an entertainment empire and create a presence in the U.S. Michael Spire is the executive editor of Variety.
They're wrapping up deals with stars like George Clooney, and now all of a sudden they're going to fund a studio and be such a player from the onset.
And Hollywood could use some more big players. Wall Street's private equity firms were financing a lot of big screen projects, but they've been pulling out. Neeraj Kaushal with the National Bureau of Economic Research says Reliance is well suited for this kind of partnership.
Reliance is very good at raising money nationally as well as internationally, so it would be a good deal for both of them.
And make DreamWorks part of an international media empire. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Follow the bouncing ball in the battle between Boeing and two of its rivals, Northrop Grumman and Europe's Airbus. The investigative arm of Congress is recommending that the Air Force reopen bids for a $35 billion tanker contract. The project was awarded to Northrop and Airbus, but Boeing has protested the decision. Today, the Government Accountability Office said it found a number of significant errors that could have affected the outcome of what was a close competition between Boeing and Northrop Grumman. Wall Street had some trouble getting off the ground today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Don't bother stopping me if you've heard this one before. The bad news keeps coming for some of the biggest names in banking. Morgan Stanley said today its quarterly earnings dropped 57%. Bad investment write-offs were a big part of that number, and once again it raises the question, when are all these big losses finally going to come to an end? Let's put that question to Standard & Poor's Chief Economist David Weiss. Hi, David.
Hello.
David, we've been hearing a lot from these banks that we're, in the seventh inning, this is almost over. It sure seems like this is an especially long seventh inning, though. Do these numbers tell us any more about where we are in the game?
Well, I sure suggest the game's not over.
Can we expect more of the same, or are we near the bottom here?
I think we've got most of it behind us, but most of it probably means more like 60%, not 95%. We're getting a better idea of what the losses are, who's been holding them, what the damage is going to be. The damage isn't over, but at least we're pretty sure there's a bottom to the hole. It's got a long ways to go before we're out of this. We may never know precisely when we're out of it because some of the losses will never get reported.
Let me go back to that metaphor I was drawing earlier. Is it possible here that we're heading into the second game of a doubleheader, and not only that, but it's a new team we're batting against here? We've still got on deck credit quality of corporate loans.
Well, we've still got the credit quality of corporate loans. We've still got all the issues about what could happen to the economy itself, which is what's going to affect the corporate borrowing. I think it's going to be a fairly normal recession there. But it's more like you've just, you know, you're in the sixth inning of the baseball game and you've still got a basketball game ahead of you.
David, what should we look for to know that this is finally turning around? What's it going to look like?
But in terms of the financial sector, what we have to see is an end to the write-offs. We don't think that's going to happen until at least a full year of them. So I think we have to get through at least the third quarter reports before we can even think about getting to the end. In terms of the economy, we want to start seeing home prices stabilizing. We want to see first home sales stabilizing, then home prices stabilizing. I don't think home prices are going to hit bottom until a year from now.
David Weiss is chief economist at Standard & Poor's. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
FedEx delivered some bad news today. High fuel costs and a slumping economy shaved $241 million off quarterly profits. The company is considered a bellwether of economic activity since it gives us a sense of how much is being shipped from here to there. There's another indicator you might not hear that much about. Lipstick. Jeremy Hobson joins us from Washington.
Hi there, Bob.
So I know a little lipstick on your collar can ruin a whole year, but really, what does lipstick tell us here?
Well, the theory goes as the economy slows down, lipstick sales actually tick up. And according to a company called Klein Research, that's exactly what's happening.
This is for real now, right?
That's what they say. Lipstick sales had been declining. Now they're holding steady. People like to give themselves a cheap lift when times are tough. So I went to a store called Blue Mercury in Bethesda, Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C., to see for myself. Tell me what we're looking at, and how much do these things go for?
Okay.
Because I don't know anything about lipstick.
That's fine. Oh, I didn't think that you did, but you never know. These lipsticks are roughly $24.
Now, what's happening right now in terms of lipstick sales?
It's off the charts. I mean, people are coming in. They're not just buying one. They're buying multiple items.
Now, I'm looking around this store. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, at least 8 people.
I mean, outside of this little store here, you wouldn't even know there was a recession. They're not necessarily indulging in the perfume for $195 all the time, but they will buy a little luxury, a little something to make them feel better.
Would you say you fall into that category?
I do. I don't go to the very high end. I don't go and spend what I used to spend because I think it's all the same, basically. But when you want to just have somebody do something for you, or good fragrance, or lipstick, or whatever.
And not spend too much money.
That's right. Then, yeah, I fully agree. Women will not give this up.
Yeah, it's something fun. It's not expensive. Easy way to change up my look.
So I'm not going to actually get lipstick put on myself, but the next best thing, which is some kind of skincare products.
That's right. Men don't realize that we have just as much for them as we do for women.
Which brands are you
showing
him?
I'm using the MD Skincare men's pads right now.
You're going to show him a cleanser, too, because he's using bars. So.
I know.
Oh, God.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. How old do you think I am? You can say anything. No, go right ahead.
Guess.
I am 41.
No.
Yes.
I'm not
just
joking.
Just to let you know, there's not one wrinkle, and her skin is flawless.
I honestly would have said upper 20s.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I love you. When you're done with him, we'll go out.
Now, Bob, let me just tell you who we heard from. There were customers Hannah Sky and Victoria Wilder. Jamie Jones was applying God knows what to my face, and Michelle Botta was the store manager. Luckily, Bob, we work in radio, so no one sees our faces. We're still safe, I think, spending our money on food.
Now, wait a minute. Let's not gloss this over, so to speak. I want to see pictures.
Those will not be available on the website. I can tell you that right now.
Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson in Washington. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, no pictures, but Jeremy promises to be back soon with another, shall we say, non-standard economic indicator, part of a continuing Marketplace series. We mentioned the trouble FedEx had last quarter. Well, it's got some company on the road to higher operating costs. Truckers across Europe have been protesting rising fuel prices, jamming routes, and holding up deliveries of food and other goods. Now, Britain is trying a different approach, truck sharing. Today, three dozen companies, including Coke, Tesco, and Nestle, say they'll start sharing delivery trucks in the UK. The move will slash their gas bills and could take some 800 trucks off Britain's roads this year. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
It began as a green initiative. Now it looks more like a smart financial move. The 37 companies taking part will save 6 million gallons of fuel a year. That's $60 million at today's prices. The companies have agreed to share truck space. Damien Rees is the business editor of the Daily Telegraph.
If one big UK retailer such as Tesco is sending out trucks full to one distribution centre or store, the idea is that they won't come back empty, but they may well come back with the goods of a rival company.
Some of the companies are more than rivals. They're at each other's throats. Coca-Cola and Pepsi, Tesco and Walmart's Asda. But Tesco spokesman Trevor Datson says, with the UK facing the highest fuel prices in Europe, it makes sense to cooperate.
We remain fierce competitors on price. We always will. But there are some areas that, you know, you can really pull together and do something quite significant.
Independent haulers may not be so keen on the truck share initiative. It could well cut into their business. But analysts welcome the move, with one or two reservations. Justin Urquhart-Stewart is with Seven Investment.
I mean, it's a very good idea. I'm actually surprised in terms of cost. They haven't actually already done it before. But it's going to lead to the inevitable. You know what's going to happen. The wrong thing is going to end up in the wrong place.
The organisers claim that a pilot scheme went without a hitch, and they're urging other companies to join up. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, an Italian co-op offers clean wages in lieu of old crime.
Mafia businesses pay about half the minimum wage. So people began asking us for work. A wonderful slap in the face at the mafia.
But first, let's do the numbers. Renewed credit fears sent a tremor through the Wall Street area today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1%, or 131 points, to close at 12,029. The Nasdaq lost 1.1%, or 28 points, to finish at 2429. The S&P 500 was off 0.9%, or 13 points, to end the day at 1337. We told you about Morgan Stanley's troubles, but investors had already accounted for the 61% drop in the investment bank's second quarter profit. Morgan shares inched up 0.25%. Regional banks had another rough session after Fifth Third Bank Corp said it needs to raise $2 billion to shore up its balance sheet. Its stock slid more than 27%. Crude oil bubbled up to more than $136 a barrel. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.14. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board reports its index of leading economic indicators for May. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee discusses the impact of illegal drug use in the U.S. And the House Financial Services Committee holds a hearing on protecting tenants and maintaining federally assisted affordable rents. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. You've heard us talk about the efforts of federal regulators to rein in the speculation in the commodities market. Oil futures regulators in Britain and the U.S. have now come to an agreement. They'll plug what's referred to as the London loophole that allows traders to step around regulations. Commentator and economist Robert Reich has taken a look at all the factors at play in the speculation market. He says the problem isn't the speculators, it's the enablers.
If it were just supply and demand, gas would probably be selling for around $3.50 a gallon, not $4, and food would be 20% cheaper. The difference is due to speculation. Of course, all markets are speculative to some degree. Every time we purchase a share of stock, we're speculating. Problems occur when prices are bid upward, not because underlying values are rising, but because investors expect other investors to make the same gamble. This can create a bubble. And whether it's crude oil or corn, houses or financial derivatives, or the stock market before the great crash of 1929, speculative bubbles cause huge market disruptions, both when they fill up and when they pop. Sometimes bubbles are manipulated. Prominent investors who hold certain stocks or commodity futures will publicly predict when those prices will rise, and then they profit when others act on those predictions. Alternatively, certain institutional investors are so large they move the markets, prompting other big investors to make the same move. That's why some members of Congress want to ban large institutions from commodities futures markets, or at least limit the size of stakes each investor can hold. But the biggest speculative bubbles happen when investors don't need to use their own money and can borrow to the hilt for whatever looks promising. That's why margin requirements were imposed on individual investors after the great crash, proving that another way to prevent excessive speculation is to require certain minimum levels of collateral. The failure to require down payments from homebuyers when mortgages became dirt cheap beginning in 2003 contributed to the housing bubble. The failure to require investment banks to risk their own capital when they made risky bets on derivatives led to the credit crisis. So what about minimal collateral for investments in commodities futures, like oil? You see, the problem isn't speculation per se, whether it's oil or food, financial derivatives, or houses. The real problem is the failure of government to curb excessive speculation.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org, then click on Contact. Ten years ago, people in the southern Italian region of Sicily wouldn't dare talk publicly about the mafia. Today, they're making the mob an offer it can't refuse. They're taking over its land. In Palermo, Megan Williams has been taking a look into a mafia-busting movement known as Libera Terra.
The last time this store in downtown Palermo was in business, it sold clothing and laundered money. This time round, it's as clean as it gets. The mafia boss who once owned the shop is now in prison, and for the first time in Italy, a Libera Terra business co-op is moving in. Libera Terra literally means liberated land. It refers to a range of organic products produced by co-ops on land that once belonged to the mafia, land the Italian government now confiscates and hands over to clean businesses. Organizer Umberto Di Maggio calls the new store opening a kind of moon landing for the anti-mafia movement.
It's a beautiful day because the state has taken away from the mafia a store that it illegally obtained, and in it, products from honest, hardworking Sicilians will now be sold.
Those products come from 30 farm co-ops and businesses in southern Italy, land that in Sicily alone now employs up to 150 young people.
Il primo è la pasta.
Everything from the olive oil to the wine is named after anti-mafia heroes. Di Maggio says at first fear of the mafia made it tough to hire even unemployed locals to help out with the grape harvest.
Nessuno.
But then people began to hear that we hire people legally, that we paid benefits and insurance, that we paid minimum wage. Mafia businesses pay about half the minimum wage. So people began asking us for work, a wonderful slap in the face at the mafia.
Almost 8,000 properties have been seized in the last decade or so. But half are still waiting to be assigned to local governments, who then hand them over to co-ops or community groups. This store in Palermo, for instance, was empty for 14 years before today's opening. Antonia Maruccia is the government coordinator for mafia property confiscated by the Italian state.
This is partly because the mafia undermines the process with legal challenges and intimidation, but it's also because Italy has so many conflicting laws.
A half-hour drive south of Palermo, a stone farmhouse sits on a stunning stretch of hilly land. Cows graze and bright crimson poppies dot the fields. Italian authorities seized the property from the Brusca Mafia clan 2 decades ago. Only recently was it handed over to one of the Liberatera co-ops, who converted it into a charming bed and breakfast with a riding stable. Salvatore Gibino gives me a tour of a nearby orchard where olives and pear trees and grapevines grow.
We are in San Civirello, and we are in the confiscated land.
Gibino greets 40-year-old Salvo Daidoni, who cuts the grass under some olive trees. The men joke about how just a decade ago, neither would have had the courage to work for an anti-mafia co-op, let alone do an interview about the mafia. Still, Daidoni's frustrated at the pace of change. He points to a distant hill that the state seized from the mafia 4 years ago. That's just been sitting there.
The state could be doing a lot more to speed things up and keep the land in use.
When the land sits fallow, he says, some locals complain that at least when the mafia owned it, it got harvested. But Gibino says the mentality is changing, especially among young Sicilians, that with groups like Liberatera, it's no longer fear that's contagious, but courage. Near Palermo, Sicily, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, credit is crunched around the world, but people still want to roll the dice at the casinos. Global gambling revenue is expected to pass $155 billion in 2012, a bump up from $114 billion last year. That's according to a report today from PricewaterhouseCoopers. No surprise, the fastest growth will be in Asia. Places like Macau, Singapore, and Thailand will together generate annual increases of about 15%. The U.S. will overall remain strong, but the poor economy will dampen the party. Both Atlantic City, New Jersey, and the state of Nevada, home to Las Vegas, will see revenues decline this year and next. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 131 points, 1%. The Nasdaq fell 28 points, 1.1%. And the S&P 500 lost 13 points, 0.9%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Next time on the program, small businesses bank on the power of plastic.
Building the internet site, marketing, paying for trips, all of that. Came from really the credit cards.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.